Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Wandering through a city would be a very vibrant experience together, where it would be normal to go into the main city and see bartering in the streets by people who were practicing their spells and being compensated, or people who were selling items that they'd collected. There's a lovely guild hall. And so if you imagine sort of a medieval town, then you're not far off. And there are dwarves, and there are humans, and there are elves, and there are taurens. And the kind of amazing thing that happened with Corrupted Blood is that instantly, as it spread into the urban centers, all of normal life just ground to a halt.
That was Professor Nina Pfefferman. She researches the mathematics of systems through networks, with a focus on disease. She's talking about an incident called Corrupted Blood in the multiplayer video game World of Warcraft, otherwise known as WoW. I'm Neil Denny, and in this episode of Converging Cultures, I want to look at how artists, writers, and scientists have approached pandemics and outbreaks of disease.
Yeah, I've been gaming since Dungeons and Dragons tabletop. So my main character at that time was a night elf. But one of the challenges was a new boss, a new high level malevolent creature, and he was beautiful, Zakhar. He was this gigantic Chinese dragon, basically. He moved in this beautiful snake-like fashion, and one of the spells that he cast as part of fighting him was this Corrupted Blood spell, which was meant to be an additional nuisance, as opposed to a cataclysmic, oh my god, we've just erased society. So if you were a party of high-level players, what happened is that he would cast it on one of your players, and the function of the debuff was not only that it periodically caused damage to you, but that it caused you to recast the spell yourself in a radius around yourself. So there are two ways that were natively constructed in the game to be cured of Corrupted Blood. One was to die, which does tend to solve infectious diseases, although not all of them. The other was to defeat Hakar. But unfortunately, there were two aspects that weren't necessarily planned. And so I think one of them was probably in the back of somebody's mind, and that was running away, and then run straight back to an urban center. And that's actually where things did not go as planned, and people started dying. And then, of course, people started going to healers and asking the healers to help. And then the healers, of course, became modes both of the treatment, but also conduits of infection. And then everything just really collapsed. And it was a number of days before really even they were able to really walk into the town and experience the full weight of what it means for the function of normal society to come to a crashing halt. Was an amazing thing, and Corrupted Blood had these incredible emotionally weighty effects, and I don't think if the designers had set out to make it a sort of bone-chilling experience to see society crumble around you as a result of this, I don't think they could have done better. So we saw actually the full gamut, I think, of responses that have been anticipated and described, everything from sort of a fatalism of like, well, I've always wanted to do the equivalent of running around naked with a rubber glove on my head. but you can't actually do that in World of Warcraft. To people who decided to roleplay very seriously as Good Samaritans, or people trying to enforce blockades or behave well. But the way people, I think, internalized some of the behavior, both, I think, showed how easily the reactions that are described to us both from history and from art become very natural in that setting, whereas they seem very unreal when you're hearing them described, but to watch them happen inside the setting was kind of amazing. And then also, I think people who took their inspiration for how they should behave in such a setting from histories and from art that they had seen. So there was someone who decided that what he needed to do was be a prophet of doom from the town hall steps. And so he was standing there relating his experience of watching what was unfolding all around us, but as though it was end times. And so he, like, you should have watched him. He exploded, and there was panic in the streets, and the end is coming. That's not epidemiologically sound practice, but it's a very human endeavor, and I think that's a beautiful story that glorifies the ability of humans to find peace in denial. That is not a way to be safe, but it is a way to live when you are unsafe.
What exactly is a pandemic?
So a pandemic has a technical definition that's actually not how it gets used colloquially. And so a pandemic is simply an ongoing outbreak. So an outbreak is when transmission is increasing. More people are getting sick than are recovering on multiple continents at once, simultaneously. So that means that there can be incredibly benign pandemics. There are frequently pandemics of colds. We're not really worried about that, but technically speaking, that can be a pandemic. When we colloquially use the word pandemic, and in fact, we do tend to let the colloquialism spill over into technical discussion, what we mean is an outbreak of global concern occurring on multiple continents simultaneously. And so when we say global concern, we mean likely to cause large-scale morbidity or mortality.
We don't know how we will react to something until it actually happens. It's a situation that fascinated the writer Albert Camus in his 1947 novel, The Plague. Neil Bartlett has adapted the play for the Arcola Theatre in Dalston, London.
I had first read The Plague when I was a teenager. It's one of the sort of list of serious books that if you're a bookish, slightly rebellious teenager that you read and you dream of smoking French cigarettes and understanding existentialism. And then I put it away on my bookshelf. And a couple of years ago, something about the way the world is turning and the kind of rhetoric and language that is being used now in all sorts of contexts, ideas of invasion, ideas of infection, ideas of who is clean and who is tainted, who has the right to be somewhere, who doesn't have the right to be somewhere. Something made me remember the story, and in particular, an extremely shocking sentence that occurs right at the end of the book, where a doctor who has worked throughout the epidemic, the plague, which the story recounts, says, what you learn in a time of plague is that there is more to admire about one's fellow human beings than to despair of or despise. And like most people, I know, I'm not sure if that's true, but I really think that's a sentence worth thinking about. He does a brilliant thing in the novel. He presents the plague as being both absolutely plausible and absolutely impossible. He says in the novel, it takes place in Oran, a major city in French, then French Algeria in northern Africa, and it takes place in the 1940s. He says that in the first sentence of the novel. So you know it's not true. There was no outbreak of plague, of bubonic plague, in Oran in the 1940s. And yet he describes the plague with such forensic documentary realism that you have to admit to the possibility of this actually happening. Camus' plague starts with one person trying to find their keys to the door to their apartment, and they look down and there is a rat dying in the hallway. And that's where it starts. First of all, there's one rat, then there's two, then there's three. And then the caretaker in the building where the rats have died says, that's funny, I've got a sore throat. And then within weeks, the city is plunged into catastrophe. And eventually the death toll sweeps away a large part of the city. It's quarantined. And then eventually a serum begins to have some effects. And then the plague goes whence it came. However, the novel ends with the famous caveat.
Indeed, as he listened to the cries of joy that rose above the town, Ryu recalled that this joy was always under threat. He knew that this happy crowd was unaware of something that one can read in books, which is that the plague bacillus never dies or vanishes entirely, that it can remain dormant for dozens of years in furniture and clothing, that it waits patiently in bedrooms, cellars, trunks, handkerchiefs and old papers, and that perhaps the day will come when, for the instruction or misfortune of mankind, the plague will rouse its rats and send them to die in some well-contented city.
It's one of the great sentences in French literature, the ending of the novel. And that sentence rings true in all sorts of appalling ways. It's very clear he's not talking just about the bacillus that carries bubonic plague in mammal to human transmission. He's talking about all the evils which lie dormant and which erupt. Does any epidemic of any kind ever just happen? No, nothing ever just happens. Nothing in human affairs just happens. Straight away, the feeling is, oh, what can we do? It's such a huge problem. It's such an overwhelming problem. So the mythology of plague makes a plague of any kind much harder to combat. At the grassroots level of asking voters to approve of funding programs, because people are going to say, well, what can you do?
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
How important is our reaction to a pandemic? Now, we obviously can't create a real outbreak of disease. So instead, we sent one of our producers to try out the board game Pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, which cards have you guys
got? Well, I've got a Baghdad or Istanbul.
Oh, okay, so you could go into those areas and sort
yeah,
them.
I could.
I feel like I've got some pretty useful cards because I've got Mexico.
My name is Rob Harris. I'm a games designer. I work with board games and I also design games for museums and educational institutions. Well, basically, Pandemic is a game where we all work on the same team. So it's a cooperative game. So quite different from the games of sort of 80s and 90s where you're all sort of fighting tooth and nail and all families fall out. We're all going to win together or lose together. During the game, there's going to be plenty of outbreaks of four different colours of diseases. And they're basically going to keep spreading out across the board. And if they overwhelm the world, then we lose, and there's a mass panic, and we've basically done our jobs very badly, and mankind is wiped out. So we'll be trying to eradicate and cure those diseases by working together.
I'm Robbie. I'm just a hardworking medic who's just trying to remove all the cubes of a single colour every time I treat the city and administer known cures for free. That's all I'm trying to do, according to my card.
Yep.
I am a green operations expert, but look, I look like a doer. He's on the walkie-talkie.
It's quite interesting, actually, that a theme where you essentially is about the possibility of the world being wiped out is so popular and such a kind of family game as well, which is really nice. It just goes to show that you can never know which themes are going to work. Dum, dum, dum. You can lose this game very quickly, by the way.
Oh, really?
I'd point that out. Hopefully we won't.
Well, it could be a matter of, you know...
It could be a matter of turns if we get overwhelmed.
Really?
Essen, which is... Funny, it's not a major city in Germany.
No, it's not.
While the team continues playing, I want to look at how pandemics have played out in popular culture, starting with the most famous example, the zombie. Roger Luckhurst is professor in modern and contemporary literature at Birkbeck, London.
Well, the standard answer for what the zombie represents after Romero is that they are a kind of version of ourselves, but quite a bleak version of ourselves as idiots, really, as a kind of mindless mess. So Dawn of the Dead is the classic film where they wander around a shopping mall and, you know, the narrative is, well, they have some kind of instinct that's left. They come back to what's most important to them, which turns out to be shopping. And that's been a very, very influential narrative, and you'll find professors like me are constantly saying that's what zombies represent. But I think it's not just that, if it was just that, I think it wouldn't have lasted so long. And like vampires, they're so malleable and mobile as a metaphor. I think things like The Walking Dead are trying to work out precisely where the limits of the human are. And what it means to be a human, what it means to sympathise or empathise with other human beings. So I think, you know, right now we inevitably see hordes and hordes and hordes of people trying to get through walls, trying to get through gates. It inevitably evokes refugee crisis, of mass migration, of anxiety about foreigners, of the threat of foreigners to the way of life and so on. So there are these things that I think are constantly roiling around this metaphor of the zombie. This great stuff by Priscilla Wald about the outbreak narrative. I mean, it's a book that's about 10 years old, and Priscilla Wald talks about a kind of standard narrative about how we as cultures in the West tend to narrate the beginning of outbreaks, and it's nearly always that idea of the lone individual, the patient zero, who brings death to the culture, whether it's Typhoid Mary or whether it's patient zero, that whole mythical figure at the beginning of the AIDS outbreak, and this sense of it starting from a single person who infects through some kind of immorality, really, some, you know, sexual transmission or inappropriate intimacy or being dirty foreigner, these kinds of narratives, and then it sort of spreads out from there. And that idea of the outbreak narrative is clearly something that's been picked up in current pandemics. So we nearly always talk about ideas of the patient zero, which is then turned into cultural narratives like the zombie as well. I mean, I think it's... And they merge together. So right at the beginning of the AIDS crisis, for example, the Journal of the American Medical Association published an article called Night of the Living Dead about this new outbreak in New York of this new kind of disease. And they called it that because they suspected that it was coming from Haiti. So that it was migrants who were coming up the coast carrying this kind of exotic foreign disease that was infecting American young men. And that idea of an outbreak coming from beyond is exactly the same as Typhoid Mary coming from Ireland and infecting, again, the young American state. Always the same kind of narrative. And you can see that again in popular narratives of zombie outbreaks as well. Very striking that during the Ebola outbreak, in West Africa, there were doctored images from the film World War Z that were passed around saying that the Ebola victims are coming back from the dead, and they are going to infect you. You need to, this is what they look like, you need to kind of defend yourself from them. So there's still a lot of fear, I think. But on the other hand, because we're interested in the subjectivity of the zombie now, I think there is this sense in which people are trying to imagine what it might be like in that situation, and not just abject them.
Multimedia artist John Walter wants to repair the dialogue between science and the way in which we digest pandemics and culture by focusing on HIV. We met him in his studio in South London.
So I'm John Walter and I'm an artist, and I make a variety of things. I'm not really working in one medium, but I come from a painting background and a drawing background. I make video, I make installation, I make performance, sculpture, prints, books, you name it. So what's missing in the discussion around HIV is humour, dark humour very often, although that does occur, but not necessarily in the visual representation of it. A way to get people engaged in it that aren't already. So there's a strong community of artists, writers, academics for whom it is their interest. But how do you get people that don't know they're interested in it to care? And I do that by bringing in things that they might be interested in, such as Coronation Street or Nasher from the Beano. The normal mode is to illustrate the science and really be a craftsperson. That's not what I'm doing. I'm using the science as metaphor for something else, and it's innovating the art, and then hopefully the art is innovating the science in terms of how we exchange ideas creatively. Yeah, I've sort of found myself working in this way, partly I think because I knew more and more people that were HIV positive, or that this was more of an issue, and it's always been an issue for me in terms of my sex life and something that I might encounter. But then also in terms of working with a scientist. So yeah, I suppose I get to indulge both sides of my brain, the very academic side and then this very playful side. Something that Greg and I agree on, and the way I think he would describe it, is it's not important why I'm interested in something, it's important why you are, and what are your interests, and how do I explain it to you in your terms. So in the collaboration, really we're displacing each other's interests within one another and finding unexpected information. And so that meeting point is really a creative one in which art and science both can benefit from the discussion. And I go and attend lab meetings on a very practical basis and immerse myself in the science. I read up on the science, I read the papers, I get to know the people. And I also hang out with them socially. So it works on a formal and an informal basis. I suppose the fear aspect is the thing to get over. And the way I've dealt with that partly is using humour, which seems like a counterintuitive move, and also colour and visual excess and decorativeness and joy, actually, because it's an incredibly sophisticated thing. The way the virus works, I respect it incredibly, because it interacts with the host cell so much, and that's, you can't really look at one without looking at the other. I have a more pragmatic approach to the virus, in that I think you have to engage with it in order to... I don't think it's about defeating it. You can use military narratives around minefields in terms of thinking about how the virus populates itself. But in terms of... I don't see it as needing to defeat it. Yeah, I don't think there is a hurdle to overcome now in the same way as there was in the 80s and 90s. It's different. It's, you know, there is an issue around access to PrEP, and that should come in time here. It's going through in Scotland, it seems. I don't know what we have to fight for. That's not my interest. My interest is in that there is a different way of engaging with viruses, in terms of understanding them for our own benefit, because they don't work how I thought they did, and also in terms of as metaphor for art.
back to our team playing Pandemic.
Do you think I should try and sort this out, like you have in New York, or should maybe I use one of the blacks?
We can spread around a bit, I think.
So maybe I could go back.
Maybe good for you to go over there, and then you could build the research.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is Pandemic's definitely one of the games that's popularized cooperative games. We're all used to games where, you know, we compete, like Monopoly and those sort of games. We play at Christmas and everybody falls out and go on for hours and hours. This game actually sets the game up against the players, so all the players either win together or lose together. One of the things I love about Pandemic is that you're essentially heroes. You're playing a heroic actions, but you're not sort of astronauts or cowboys or what have you. You are members of the CDC, you know, you're scientists. You're the sort of unsung heroes that, you know, if there is an outbreak, as there was of Ebola in Africa, these are the people that fly out, you know, to sort this out. And we don't really ever get to know their names, but with this game, we get to play as them, you know, and hopefully be as successful as they were at that time. I think quite often games and art films in general, they sort of look at pandemics in a way of a sort of zombie movie, you know, that everything's gone terrible and there's just, it's almost a survivor instinct. You have to survive the inevitable. Whereas this game sort of turns that on the head and said, no, we don't need to go down that route. We can actually solve the problem before it happens. And in fact, you know, if we win the game, then we've eradicated all of the diseases.
If.
That's a big if at this point in the game. Let's see.
Madrid.
Oh, no. Okay. No.
Well, Madrid is connected, unfortunately.
Can I go here? So, oh, God, Madrid's very connected.
So, okay.
This is a disaster.
This
I'm
is
panicking,
not
guys.
Good.
That's a three, so God, so that's four.
So now let's go, we need one, and then that's going to go
yeah,
as
no,
well.
Yeah, and then all of these go. It's
oh,
over.
It's a
well.
Chain reaction.
It's over.
That goes again.
It's a domino effect. Oh, no!
No!
The world was not safe in our hands, gentlemen. We ignored the blues for too long, I think.
Yeah.
We actually did really well. We cured two.
That's
we're
good.
On the brink of curing red as well. So.
One of the reasons there's so much panic around pandemics is because they often take us by surprise. So how can we tell when an outbreak is going to happen? We spoke to Lloyds Bank's Emerging Risks team to see if it's possible to predict a pandemic.
Okay, yeah, Trevor Maynard, Head of Innovation at Lloyds of London. This report was aimed very much at the market, the insurance market, to say, you know, you might not be necessarily covering pandemic explicitly, but, you know, it will have economic effects and think through how it might affect you. So pandemics have continually hit the world with a return period for influenza of about 30 to 50 years since about the 1600s. So we realised that there was a potential for this to happen in the next 10 years just by looking at the past, and there's no reason to suppose the past won't repeat itself. And in a sense, almost on cue, the swine flu pandemic did hit in 2009. So that's how we became convinced by looking at the science, and that's always our approach, actually, is to be guided by the very strong science in this subject. Yeah. So in the report on pandemics, I guess the key finding was that it was a very important business issue, had very significant economic effects potentially, all depending on the severity of the pandemic, but it was something we realised had insurance relevance and we needed to think about. So the risk of a pandemic in the UK and mainland Europe, in the majority due to, you know, good health services, etc., is probably lower than in some other parts of the world. But I guess the key take home is that just because we have that, because of the globalised travel and the fact that, you know, we're all human beings at the end of the world, the end of the day. Ooh, that was a. Can I say that one again?
But it's not all doom and gloom. Here's Neil Bartlett again, talking about the message of the plague.
I don't think the message of the book, which is terrifying, is either optimistic or pessimistic. I think it is asking of each of us to imagine, in a time of plague, what would you do? And also perhaps to imagine you are living in a time of plague. This is not a hypothetical situation. Catastrophe is upon us. How are you responding to that? The novel shows a small group of interconnected characters, each of whom respond to the epidemic in very different ways. Some people despair and simply say, it's the way of the world, there is nothing that can be done. Some people fight heroically. Some people fight resolutely, unheroically. They say there's no heroism about this. One character says, it's like the question of 2 + 2 = 4. Either they equal 4 or they don't. Either we have a moral duty to battle against this or we don't. So it presents you with a very challengingly wide range of moral options, spiritual options.
What's true of all the evils in the world is true of plague as well. It helps men to rise above themselves. All the same, when you see the misery it brings, you need to be a madman, or a coward, or stone blind to give in tamely to the plague.
Converging Cultures was made possible with the help of the Wellcome Trust. The series was written by Caroline Christie, and you can find more interesting articles and podcasts at littleatoms.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Before Shopify, were you wondering, where are my sales at? Now you're selling with Shopify, the global commerce platform supercharging your selling. You have no problem selling online, in person, on social media, and beyond. Gary, easy on the cha-ching.
Oh, sorry, but my Shopify sales are through the roof.
Start selling with Shopify today and discover how millions of businesses around the world use Shopify to ignite their selling. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen. Shopify.com/listen.